Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, on January 18th, 2013, 15-year-old Nehemiah Griego shot and killed his father, mother, and three younger siblings. Whenever there's a mass shooting like this, we ask, why? What went wrong? Dr. Regina Griego, Nehemiah's aunt, has just published a memoir, Sins of the System, which seeks to answer those very questions. Dr. Regina Griego, congratulations on your memoir and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen.
So I really want to hear what went wrong for Nehemiah and later get to the sins of the system. But I think listeners really need more details on January 18, 2013. So to the extent you are comfortable in doing so, please tell us about Nehemiah's actions that day, please.
The actual event happened on January 19th, and we didn't discover what went on until the 20th. And so their deaths are recorded as January 20th, but it was the early morning, about 1:30 in the morning on January 19th, that Nehemiah first shot his mother. And we found out through the coroner that that was two shots, and she was in her bed asleep. He had been waiting for the family to go to sleep. And then his brother was sleeping in that room with his mother.
His nine-year-old brother.
And he woke up and saw his mother bleeding and was trying to clean off the blood. And then at that point, Nehemiah shot his brother, and they were, you know, found in the bed together with his body across his mother's. And then Nehemiah then went to his sister's room, which is down the hall. There's the boys' room between the two rooms, and first shot his 6-year-old sister once, and then ultimately shot the 2-year-old. And what he said was he lost his consciousness. And my summation is that he just didn't know how to take care of them, because ultimately he was after shooting his father, who was not in the home at the time.
And he was working at a homeless shelter at night, correct?
He was. He was working at a homeless shelter. And he had done various odd jobs, but that's one of
and
the ones that...
this is your brother, right? Your younger brother?
This is my brother. This is my brother, who is 18 months younger than I am.
Okay. And then your younger brother comes home, and then what happens?
Nehemiah waited several hours. He was coming home at 6:30, and he went into the downstairs bathroom, and he knew when his dad would come through, he would walk past him to the stairwell where he would go up to his bedroom. And Nehemiah came out of the bathroom and in the dark shot in his direction. And now he had moved from a .22 to a AR-15 like weapon. He practiced weapons with his dad often, so he knew about the different weapons. And then he turned on the light, walked over to his father, and his father reached for his boot. And in reaction, Nehemiah shot one more time, and that was a shot to the head. And my brother, they say he would have died from the first set of wounds, but basically that was what happened that night.
So having just gone through this for us, and thank you for doing that, I mean, I wonder if you can go back to your initial reactions, because just hearing you, it's so sad and upsetting just to hear you talk about it. I can't imagine what you thought when you first heard about it.
Well, things revealed themselves over time. The initial, you know, discussion with the police, they told us what they found, you know, where they found the bodies, you know, the timing, the exact things that happened revealed themselves either through the set of hearings or as we engaged in therapy with Nehemiah. So the whole bit at the end where he and his father locked eyes before he shot him that last time, didn't come out until I talked with Nehemiah over months. And that was one of the things that gave him nightmares. And of course, it gave me nightmares, because I can just imagine, you know, my brother having his son, you know, knowing that he, before he passed, that that was his son.
Yeah, I don't know if it can get much worse for a parent than that.
No.
So was your, when you first started to hear about this, was your reaction instinctively to, I'm going to help Nehemiah, or you, did you feel conflicted, or how did you feel about it?
Honestly, my instinct was to help Nehemiah almost immediately that night that I found out what happened, because it just didn't make any sense. This was a young man that we had just spent time with over the Christmas holiday. He, you know, every time he came around, you know, he talked with me, and he was a very polite young man. And I was completely unaware of the number of weapons my brother kept or how he was training his son. And so it just didn't make sense to me in my instinct. This was a boy that wasn't in trouble with the law, didn't do drugs, never, he was very controlled in his environment. And so my instinct was, you know, something happened to that kid's brain, and now what's going to happen?
So your instinct is to try to help him, to get treatment for him. And does that turn out to be difficult?
Very difficult. He was first put in the detention center, which in essence, he had a counselor, but her job was to just keep him quiet and know if he was going to be getting into, you know, so that he wasn't suicidal or homicidal. He was never homicidal after he started taking drugs. He was more suicidal than he was anything, and he was on suicide watch.
So how did you go about getting him treatment? That's not treatment. That's just preventing him from killing himself or killing someone else, right?
Correct. And that was the biggest problem. So we, as a family, decided to bring in a very qualified therapist. In fact, he was a longtime teacher at UNM, and he had many credentials that with these kinds of adolescents. And so we brought him in to the detention center for a while. And then meanwhile, we worked really hard with the defense team, in particular, the social worker, to get him into the adolescent treatment center here in Albuquerque.
And were you successful in doing that? Did you get him into the center?
Yes, we did. And that was truly transformative for him. He jumped 4 grades in a period of 19 months. He was supposed to be homeschooled, but he wasn't. They quit teaching him at 3rd grade. His mother stopped teaching him. So he jumped 4 grades. He was involved in in-depth counseling there, and then family counseling. And it was truly a transformative experience for him, those 21 months or so that he was there.
So that's terrific news for him. If he's ever going to get out, right, he needs to be mentally sound, and he needs to be educated beyond the 3rd grade, right, in order to,
right,
to function in society. And that's what you're trying to do.
Right, exactly.
So let me mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. And I am very pleased to be talking today with Dr. Regina Griego. Dr. Griego is the aunt of Nehemiah Griego, and Dr. Griego is herself a PhD in computer engineering. She was a systems analyst for Sandia Labs, and she's written a memoir called Sense of the System. And Regina, I'd like to turn to the legal situation Nehemiah was in, because the fact that he was getting treatment really could aid him in his legal situation. And the situation for juveniles is very different than adults when it comes to criminal wrongs, because in the juvenile system, the idea is to try to rehabilitate, if possible, the juvenile, whereas, you know, our criminal system is mostly punitive. But the big exception to this is if there's a capital murder, first-degree murder, then there is no treatment possibility. You're sentenced as an adult, and that's it. So initially, that was the legal setting, because Nehemiah's crimes obviously fit into first-degree murder. So how did it come about that the state accepted a plea for second-degree murder? Do you have any idea why they did that?
When Judge Romero was assigned out of the children's court, he worked with both sides, and ultimately they found a plea that was acceptable, second degree for the parents, and child abuse resulting in death for the three children. And the code is written such that with that, he could get an amenability hearing.
So I have a theory about why the state did this. The state wasn't trying to help Nehemiah. They wanted to put him away, and they tried to put him away, and they did put him away for as long as possible. My theory is that they thought that his chances of getting off by reason of insanity, as an insanity defense, were actually greater than his chances of being found treatable and being let out of the system at 21. They thought they had a better chance of keeping him in jail if they let him plead to second-degree murder. And I think the reason for this is, and you can react to this, is there was so much proof of abuse and neglect and his really depleted mental state. And so before we go on, I'd really like, to the extent you can, and I know this concerns your family and your brother, but I wonder if you can tell us how Nehemiah was treated. What was the abuse and neglect that caused this condition for him?
Well, Stephen, that's an interesting theory. I have never heard that theory in all of our discussions about this.
And, right.
and I'm curious about it now. I'm going to have to think about it. But yeah, Nehemiah, starting at age 11, his father was basically grooming him to be a soldier.
What does that mean, grooming an 11-year-old to be a soldier?
Well, teaching him how to use weapons, having him patrol the property, including going up on the roof and sighting the neighbors with the gun, and having him wear backpacks and combat boots, running with him for 2 to 3 miles, things like that, and teaching him everything there was to know about weapons, how to put them together, how to take them apart, when you would use them, under what conditions, that kind of thing. But when he was 11 years old, he sassed his mother back. You know, that's about the time that the, you know, adolescent behavior starts, you know, 11, 12 years old. And he jumped on his son and knocked him out till he was actually, you know, unconscious. And later on with the brain scans, they determined that he had a traumatic brain injury. Now, the beatings pretty much continued. His dad was in excess of 250 pounds, about 6 feet. And this child was 5'7", 5'8", and 100 pounds when they took him into custody. So he was a big man. He was malnourished. There was not a lot of food in the home. The mother usually cooked for the father, and that's when the kids could, you know, have food. But in general, the kids just foraged around with what they could find. And they did not have regular sleeping hours, any kind of schedule. They weren't going to school. So it was a very unstructured home from that regard. And his mother was emotionally abusive primarily. And then, like I say, he was isolated. When my brother was a pastor at Calvary, he did go. All the kids went to Calvary with him every day, and they just hung out in the area. But once he lost his pastor position, which was about 10 months before everything happened, Nehemiah just pretty much stayed at home. His mother did not drive. She was not allowed to leave the house, let alone the grounds of their property. My brother would not allow her to leave the house. And so he was gone periods of time, and she had to stay in the house and with the kids.
So one thing that's in your book that I found striking was that Nehemiah was hallucinating. He had delusions. He thought he was being mm-hmm. ordered about by someone named Sarge,
right?
And considered it, and had to call his father commander. I mean, this is really strange stuff.
Yeah, and you know. I in the book, I craft the notion, or I craft the story of my brother's abuse. And I truly believe that even when he was in the 82nd Airborne, that he did sustain some amount of trauma there as well. And so I think he had PTSD and other things like that. And he used his military, the combination of his military stuff and his gang activity to teach Nehemiah. And so he was very rigid, and they spoke in military speak. Like I said, he was being trained to be a soldier.
Yeah, like territory. They didn't talk about the yard. They talked about their territory.
Correct. And the Eastern Front, the Western Front, things yeah. like that. And to this day, you know, I talked to Nehemiah, and he still uses some of those terms. And but this, yes, the hallucinations were a key factor too. You know, I, as I say in the book, there were many factors that came together, perhaps because of the traumatic, you know, being beat to the head. It's I don't know. It could be that it's just the mental illness progression. But he had hallucinations, and he would not tell his parents about it because he thought they would, you know, think that there were demons, because they didn't believe in psychology or psychotherapy. They were of the mind that those were cult kind of activities. And so this kid kept to himself, and he had auditory and visual hallucinations. So he had several visual hallucinations as well. But this one character, Sarge, was the most, they called him a command hallucination, most oppressive and pressing voice that he heard, including that night.
Yeah, I think you say in the book that he thought he was ordered to do this killing, and it was sort of being baited. You said, you know, why aren't you doing it? Do it, do it, do it.
Right. And he had to complete the mission. You're not completing the mission. And the mission was to escape. Honestly, he wanted to escape from his home. And this was how this delusional, troubled child conceived of that plan to escape.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. We're talking today with Dr. Regina Griego. Dr. Griego has written a book called Sins of the System. It concerns her nephew who shot and killed family members. And Dr. Griego has written a memoir about that. And you had mentioned the amenability hearing. You started to talk about it. And by the time the amenability hearing, this is a public hearing.
Yes.
And we have a child who at 15 had shot five members of his family. This was a media feeding frenzy, if I remember correctly. I mean, this was on TV constantly and in the newspapers constantly. And a part of this was that it seemed like the family was divided. Some members of the family, like you, wanted to see treatment for Nehemiah. Others thought that, you know, a long prison term was the right idea.
Well, initially, most of the family was together. It wasn't until the first amenability hearing that things started to crack apart. And my thought is two things happened, maybe three. The kid's, his sister's grief started to turn more into anger.
He had a sister and a half sister that weren't at the house, and therefore
right.
weren't harmed.
Correct. Well, my brother has five children, and they were all lived in California, and they were born of other mothers.
I see.
And then Nehemiah's full sister was here in Albuquerque living with her husband. And so they I weren't see. In the house. So they also, when the truth started coming out about their father, I think that's the part that was the most sensitive to them. They did not yeah. want basically the truth to come out about their father. And to a large degree, that particularly the half-sister in California was convinced that, you know, it wasn't true, but she didn't spend time in the house at all. So, I mean, she did for a short period of time when she was in the ministry school, but that was when Nehemiah was younger.
So the amenability hearing comes along, the family's divided, the media's there, and actually the amenability hearing goes pretty well for Nehemiah.
Yes.
Because it's, from reading your book, it seems like obvious that he's amenable to treatment. I mean, he gets into this treatment facility, which has an amenability criteria to let people in. And then, as you said earlier, he makes all this progress. It's hard to understand why he wouldn't be amenable. And the legal standard for the state is it has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he's not amenable. And that seems like one heck of a burden given the progress he's making at the treatment center, right?
Yeah.
And so as you say, the judge Romero finds him treatable and amenable.
Right.
But then the state appeals. And the appellate court reverses it. And what's the rationale of the appellate court? Why does it get reversed?
Well, they said Judge Romero did not consider all 8 criteria for amenability, in particular, the nature of the crime.
So I read your book, and I was really interested in this. And I actually went and looked at the appellate court opinion. And it seemed to me like this was a key bad thing for Nehemiah's release, because even Nehemiah's expert witnesses seemed to say that he needed treatment beyond 21. And under the state statute, he has to be amenable to treatment as a child when he's the child, meaning that he has to be under 21. And therefore, it seemed to me from the appellate court decision that there simply isn't any way that he falls into that category, according to the appellate court, which means that he's not amenable to treatment as a child. I don't know, what's your reaction to what I'm saying?
Well, the experts said various things, but they did say, at least a couple of them said, if you let him out today, I do not think he will reoffend.
They didn't say he was dangerous.
No, they didn't.
They also said he needed continuing treatment.
But he could use continued treatment to deal with his mental health issue, yes.
And so the long and the short of it, then, when the case comes back down, it ends up with a different judge, Judge Hart. And Judge Hart basically says her hands are tied. And based on the appellate court ruling, she finds him not amenable, and therefore he has to be sentenced as an adult. And as an adult, he should be treated like other adults. And he gets a long sentence. You have to consider good time and all that, but it's basically 30 years, and he's not amenable to parole until he's 52. So there's a difference between getting out at 21, and now he's sentenced to 30 years and not amenable to parole until 52. That's what an incredible difference.
It is. And this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because my frustration with the juvenile system is just that, you know, you let him out at age 21, which, you know, all the experts and even myself and my youngest brother, the one that was in lockstep trying to help Nehemiah, we both felt like we wish there was another option to keep him in the custody of the state for a little bit longer. But those were the options. And that final set of hearings, we were trying to bring to the table a third option. Me and my husband were willing to pay for a private mental health institution, and that was not acceptable. And so a juvenile that needs more help, which is a lot of juveniles that do serious crimes, because their brain is not fully developed until they're 25 or 27 in that neighborhood, depending on how much trauma they've had. So that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is because there's so many things in our juvenile justice system that are broken. And that's the main one. It's very binary. It's very polarized. He stays in for a long, long time, or he gets out.
Now, even the appellate court, which made this ruling, called it a Hobson's choice.
Yeah.
So you're talking about why you wrote the book, and there's a lot in the book, and I recommend people read it. But there's some other things. One that you don't emphasize a lot, but that struck me, was that I think 4 or 5 times either CYFD or animal control was called because various people were concerned about either the animals or how the kids were being treated. and nothing ever came of it.
Right. And that was a failure of their written policy. My understanding from CYFD policy is that when somebody calls them to a home for a situation like one of the little girl's teeth were rotted out.
I mean, this is amazing that somebody notices that, calls CYFD, and then it's not pursued.
Right. They're supposed to interview the children and look into their environment.
And they didn't do it.
My brother basically chased them away. I imagine they came to the place of his work at Calvary and had a conversation with him, and he was just stern with them.
So another big hole in the system, and you mentioned this earlier, but you didn't discuss it at length, was that Nehemiah was being homeschooled, but it stopped in the third grade.
Right.
So is there, and I think you point out that there's actually no monitoring to see if somebody's actually being homeschooled. You know, somebody says they're being, a parent says they're homeschooling, and then that's it. There's nothing the state does.
Right. That's what the first things at the time that everything happened when I was discovering this, I looked it up. And, you know, his mother hadn't graduated from high school, and you're supposed to at least have a high school degree. So they registered under my brother's name, but they do not, they don't have to submit articles showing that they're making progress. They don't have to take any test. They don't have any kind of home visitation. Do you remember the Turpin case in California?
Yes.
They have the same laws. So basically all you have to do is say, I'm homeschooling this child. And there is almost, I don't think there is any monitoring that is enforced in these situations.
So one last thing I want to ask you about, and that's gun safety, because what's striking about your book is that all these weapons are, and all this ammo is just laying around, and there's kids, you know, 15, 9, 5, and 2. And in terms of gun safety, I mean, this is, you couldn't have a better argument for requiring increased gun safety, I don't think.
Exactly. Yeah. And Nehemiah's younger brother pulled a handgun on him in the months prior to what happened. And the weapons were there. They could have easily landed in any of the children's hands. And they said it was for, you know, particularly Nehemiah had access so he could protect the home. But the fact is, those guns were not secured, none of them.
We are going to have to leave it there. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Regina Griego, whose new memoir is called Sins of the System. Thanks also to my producers, Elias Henley and Tristan Klump. The executive producer of this show is Lynch Becky, and my name is Stephen Spitz. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available wherever you get podcasts. Archives of past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.